We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai, to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Kachava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Kachava, you're getting 85 plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags with code FITNESS at Kachava.com. That's 30% off for a limited time at KACHAVA.com, code FITNESS.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Raising children at the best of times is hard, but it is a little bit harder when they enter the terrible teens. And how can we make it easier? Well, to talk us through that, clinical psychotherapist Stephanie Regan is with us. Stephanie, good morning.
Good morning to you, Jonathan.
As a parent of older teens, I have a vested interest in this. What are we doing wrong, he said, in a kind of a national discourse?
Well, it depends. I suppose the very good reason to talk about parenting teenagers, and I suppose we're thinking kind of, when we were discussing this briefly, we were thinking more of the later teenagers, because really, when they're in the younger phase, you still have a lot of the normality, if you like, of the childhood parenting. But things really shift as you move towards 15, 16, 17 and move on to those years. I think, well, your kids begin to think you know very little, and they begin to become very individuated. And that whole process, I think, brings up a lot of clashes, a lot of difficulties, a lot of turmoil in the home, a lot of arguments and rows, but also a lot of turmoil for parents themselves. So it's a good reason to have a look at it.
You see, and that is the real challenge, isn't it? Because it's the teens coming into their own, the parents,
Yes. You
know, still having the knowledge that they've accrued over time. There was a phrase that I used to always think about what my own late father was. When I was 15, my father was the biggest idiot that I'd ever met. By the time he got to 21, he'd learned an awful lot.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's also a lovely process where when the child finally becomes an adult and all that turmoil is over, they will remember everything that you were and everything that you did. This is something, if I can just say, and I know we're going around this sort of in a roundabout way first, but it's something that parents have to really hold on to and learn to hold on to, which is they have to believe in their child, even when they become awkward, difficult, nasty, even to them. And they have to remember to try and hold that faith, because all the research shows that if you can keep warmth in your parenting style throughout teenage years, it will determine the future relationships that you have with your parents. So important.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the difference between autonomy and supervision, because that's the other thing that's going to change, because you can't turn around to a 17-year-old with the same authority and go, you're not doing that, because they'll turn around and say, I am, and I'm bigger than you.
Yes, and you'd move to 18, and I'm nearly 18, and I can do what I like, and the world tells me I'm an adult. But inside, what is happening, if you think about it, is the child, young adult, is still growing, is still developing. They're still living in your house, under your roof, perhaps with other children, and so you want to give them some level of autonomy because they need that, and that should be increasing every year from the time, in many ways, you know, that they are able. There should be all sorts of constant loosening of the grip, if you like, of supervision. I mean, they have to be able to make their own choices now. And your job really as a parent is to help them to make better choices. So you're really moving from that kind of supervisory kind of role with your child, that limiting role, to one more like, you know, gradual advisor. You know, you're calling on what they know. You're helping them to think better. You're asking them to make better decisions. You're asking them to participate in the decision. So you're, in many ways, you're increasing the autonomy that you are giving them. And that whole process is a kind of a support and scaffold for them as they go forward.
I mean, look, how do you deal with the, let's call it the grunt that teenagers sometimes use. When you say good morning and they grunt at you. And you yes. know, sometimes you take offence at this, but are they trying to be offensive?
Well, exactly that. They're not trying to be offensive. Teenage years, think about it, we forget ourselves because, you know, I think the teenage years in many ways in your own life, they go by in a bit of a blur. You don't care that much about your parents because you're blinded really by the sort of internal tasks and the internal shifts that are going on. And so parents need to be less concerned about the grunts, less concerned about the moods, try and step past the things that you can't do much about, you know, and focus on the things that you can. And again, it comes back to the warmth. I know that's not easy, but, you know, if you can see the grunting for what it is, that it's tiredness, it's hormonal, it's them navigating very difficult stuff in sexual terms. Does anybody fancy me? You know, all my friends are with somebody. Nothing never happens for me. Something like these things are going on in your daughter's or your son's life, and they're not telling you. And, you know, it's very interesting coming from the clinical side. When you see what they're navigating, when you see the pressures that they feel, the friendships, the ongoing sort of social media presence of all of the comments and the talk and the photos and who's here and who's there and who's got what. And yeah. they have a lot on their plate. So it's really about being very, I think, being very compassionate with them and trying to not to expect the same kind of respect and listen to my word and what I say goes and these sort of diktats that, and of course, that's different parenting styles. Some parents like a high level of supervision. You know, they believe you're in my house, my rules. I hear that from people right up till they're, you know, 18, 19, 20. And you know, those kids are just hopping out the window at 11 o'clock at night when their, kids, their parents are going to bed.
They're not going to come to you when they do have a problem, which is ultimately, exactly. as a parent, what you want them to do. The yes. other thing, the biggest issue probably for all of the parents right now who've got teenagers is mm-hmm. the phone, the social media, the not being able to concentrate on schoolwork because they're Snapchatting or watching YouTube or whatever. And it's the alien world that the parent can't relate to. You know, we can relate to study, we can relate to sleep. We can't yes. relate to that level of addiction that they have to something like TikTok. So there's a clash in every household over this, Steph. How do we deal with that?
Well, I think, you know, with great difficulty, I think it is addictive, and but it's even more addictive for them because they are navigating their social world, and it's their prime kind of interest at this point in life. So it becomes massively important. Again, I would move into the engaging them in the decision making as best you can. What do you think? You know, I would be asking the questions. Okay, you've got your Leaving Cert coming up, or you've got whatever coming up. You know, I don't think you should be, you know, doing that after, say, 10 at night, for example, or 8 at night. What do you think? Can we come to an agreement that we can both work off here? So you yeah. call them in on it and you hold them responsible. Doesn't mean that they're never going to make a mistake on it or they're going to breach it. But the point is you're bringing them into the decision making. You're bringing them into the discipline. You're also laying the responsibility upon them to follow up rather than you wagging your finger and telling them what to do, which in many ways you're not really helping them to grow well at that time either. Yeah. Because if you think about it, they're increasingly going to be alone. Always think of it as a parent. I always thought of it that way, you know, that these people are going to be in the world alone. What do you hope they will decide? What life do you think they'll have? Sorry,
just
go ahead.
One point to finish up on, Stephanie.
Yes.
Why is it, and you know, I'm getting on, right, nearly 50. So the thought of bed kind of comes to me around 10 o'clock at night and I'm going, time for sleep. My brain is shutting down. I've had a long day. Why is it then that they decide, do you know what, I'd love to have a heart-to-heart with you that might take 45 minutes? I mean, their timing is brutal. I could have this conversation at 6 o'clock over dinner. Don't be waiting until I'm half asleep.
Or your timing is brutal. You could look at it that way, you see, either. They're
oh, no.
late birds.
Nothing wrong with my timing. How dare you?
Yeah, no, but they're late birds. And I think, you know, you have to, you just, whatever way your kid will do it. I mean, I used to personally find that, you know, I love to pick up from school or pick up from an event because if you did, you got them in the car. And often that was the time you really only got the chat then. It just wasn't available. If you ask after dinner or, you know, how was college, how was school, whatever, you get, oh, fine, they're exhausted. They don't want to talk. Do you want to talk if somebody asks you the moment you come in, how did everything go at work? You kind of feel, oh, do I have to keep talking about that now? I've just stopped working. So I think it's okay in that sense. If I can say one thing that I find very regularly within the clinical setting with teenagers, and that is that parents project their own fears and world onto them. They expect them to have the childhood that they had, and they are kind of looking to those teenagers with the kind of a jaundiced eye or with a fearful eye. And they are, in some ways, we know with our children, we can relive our lives a little bit. So you have to be careful that you don't project onto them every worst piece of your own teenagehood.
Now, Stephanie Regan, clinical psychotherapist, co-host of the Tough Love podcast. Thanks for talking to us, Stephanie.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan.
Now, we have a competition running across this week on the show, courtesy of Sheen Falls Lodge and our show sponsor, Aviva. The prize is 2 nights bed and breakfast in a deluxe room with Falls views and dinner for two in the Falls restaurant on an evening of your choice. An absolutely incredible spot, the 5-star Sheen Falls Lodge. They have a Black Friday sale. You can look at all those offers right now on sheenfallslodge.ie. If you want to be able to chance to win, we are taking you again to Toy Story, 30 years after it was first released. Here's a little bit of Woody and Buzz.
Buzz! Ha! You're alive! This is great! Oh! I'm saved! I'm saved! Andy will find you here. He'll take us back to the room, and then you can tell everyone that this was all just a big mistake. Huh? Right, buddy?
I just want you to know that even though you tried to terminate me, revenge is not an idea we promote on my planet.
Oh, well, that's good.
But we're not on my planet, are we?
No.
What we want to know is, who's the very, very famous actor, probably the most famous actor globally, who gives their voice to the actor Woody? Who's the actor that gives his voice to Woody? Text the word Kerry, your answer and your name to us now on 53106 for a cost of 30 cent. And it is with thanks to sheenfallslodge.ie and their Black Friday offers and our show sponsor Aviva. Migration is one of the biggest issues facing countries across Europe, and governments are starting to crack down, including here. Just last week, the British government followed in the footsteps of the Danish government to clamp down on those seeking asylum, and the Irish are, like everything else, picking up on others' ideas. But are stricter migration policies the answer, or is this just fueling the fire of anti-migration rhetoric? Ciara Smith is a professor in the School of Law and the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway. Good morning, Ciara.
Morning, Jonathan.
There is a sense we're getting from government that they have to be seen to do something about this to try and dampen down the far right. You're concerned it could have the opposite effect.
Well, I think we know from our European counterparts that when the government sort of takes a shift to the right on migration issues, it simply emboldens the far right and turns the dial for everyone to the right. So it actually just paves the way for far right rhetoric, thus undermining the government's kind of attempt at maintaining a centrist position. So I'm not sure that it is politically very smart to be dialing up the rhetoric in this way.
I mean, you could look at it another way, though. You could say that, as we talked about earlier, the Dublin City Council decision last night to increase the rents on some of their tenants reflects how much money they're bringing in. What Jim O'Callaghan is proposing now is that asylum seekers will be obliged to contribute between 10 and 40% of their income towards their state accommodation. So, you know, what's good for the goose is arguably good for the gander. That's not feeding far right rhetoric. That is reflective of a financial reality.
I'm not sure it is, really, because the financial reality for people living in direct provision is one of poverty. So, for example, in 2023, the Vincentian Research Centre looked at the kind of poverty that exists in direct provision based on a kind of a basket of goods and services that people need to live and partake in Irish society. And they found that people in direct provision were basically had much, much less to live at a minimum adequate standard of living than the rest of the population. People in direct provision, for example, get a daily expenses allowance if they're not working, but they have no child benefit, for example. So they're already living in quite an impoverished situation on the very margins of society, because direct provision is on the margins of society. The ability to access the right to work was helpful in this regard, because it meant that people could now be working and could supplement their income. But just to say, like, imposing a charge on people who are working in direct provision is actually anti-integration and shoots the government's own policy in the foot, because it means that people will not be able to move out of direct provision because they won't be able to afford to save up for a deposit. And we already
but
know...
But isn't that the same argument levelled at people who are in social housing, that they can't save up the money to afford a deposit?
Absolutely it is. But I suppose my expertise is on the issue of direct provision. But just to say that it is, you know, the government is frequently heard lamenting the fact that people are essentially bed blockers in direct provision because people get status and then they don't move out. But the reason that they don't move out, and what I would argue is the underlying cause of all this crisis narrative, is the actual housing crisis, not any crisis in asylum. And imposing an extra charge on people in direct provision is going to make that worse. Preventing people from exiting and therefore creating a greater bottleneck in direct provision rather than easing access out of it.
Ciara, what do you make of this new trend we have of announcements from the Department of Justice that 80-odd people, women, children, families, the whole lot, have been put on a very expensive flight, most recent one going back to Tbilisi, almost showing how strong the Irish government is dealing with people who either overstay or who are denied refugee status? It's a drop in the ocean compared to the amount of people who are left in limbo as decisions are made. Why are they doing that, do you think? And is that a bit of a dog whistle?
Well, I suppose it's important to say that if you're going to have an asylum process, the inevitable outcome of that process is either that you're recognised, in which case you get to stay, or that you would be asked to leave. And deportation is the kind of the hard end of people being required to leave. And that is the inevitable outcome of the asylum process. Now, we can have a discussion about how deportation is actually given effect to and whether, you know, it's humane and so on. But it really is the end point of the system. Now, deportation is actually quite difficult for the government to effect, because there can be all sorts of practical reasons why it makes it hard to deport people. But I suppose what the government is
The most obvious reason why it's hard to deport someone is that they don't want to leave, even though they've been given instruction to leave.
Yeah, that is a reason. But also people are travelling, you know, in without documents. And there's also a reason for that. There is no safe and regular way to travel to Ireland or any other EU member state. You know, if you come from what's called a refugee producing country, that country is nearly always placed on a visa blacklist, and you'll need a visa to get in and you won't get one. So the result of that is that people do travel irregularly, and so they don't have documentation. And without documentation, you can't send someone back. So there are some of the practical difficulties that the government is facing.
Finally, on this one, Ciara, something that I have found incredibly frustrating in the last few months, and this is a far right tactic of conflating migration, economic migration, which we need to keep, you know, our hospitals staffed and to bring in skills and expertise that mightn't be here or at least is in short supply, conflating that with the asylum system and making them one, othering people, as opposed to making a key difference between someone who's claiming asylum from a country where they're afraid of their lives and the people who are coming here because we need them economically. Are you concerned, because this is a concern I have this week, are you concerned that governments through their actions are falling into that trap, that they're conflating economic migration with the asylum system and now are starting to other anybody who comes into the country?
Yes, and I think that happens at two levels. So it happens in the way you're describing, in that in rhetoric that they're assumed to be the same group. And actually, we've just, you know, we're in the process of implementing the EU Pact on Migration and Asylum. So it's done there too, where it's rolling the two concepts into one. So it's happening at that level. But also it's happening in the sense that asylum seekers are portrayed as being, unsuccessful asylum seekers are portrayed as being irregular migrants. And that's not necessarily the case, or rather they've been portrayed as economic migrants that are just pretending to be asylum seekers. But just because somebody doesn't get recognised as a refugee doesn't mean that they're an economic migrant. The definition of a refugee is actually incredibly narrow, and it excludes lots of people who are fleeing their country for human rights reasons, for war-related reasons. Because of the narrowness of the definition, they don't get recognised, which makes it easy to say, oh, they're just bogus, they're economic migrants. But in fact, that's not necessarily the case.
Okay. Look, it's a conversation that we'll have to keep having. There is a shift in Irish government policy, and I'd like to know what the listeners think of that this morning. 087 1400 106 is the number. Ciara Smith is Professor for the School of Law and Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway. Thank you for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai, to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Kachava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Kachava, you're getting 85 plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags with code FITNESS at Kachava.com. That's 30% off for a limited time at kachava.com code FITNESS.